Really?
First of all, for all those people who went outside and saw how wonderful it was outside and came back here and was done, and I'd like to give a big round of applause. I will talk, Ben Levin will talk, and Steph will talk, and we'll then move across to the altar and arms and figure out what the day meant. This, this is the 10th annual such event. When we began in 2001, it was very much an experiment. When I proposed to the director of the Smithsonian Associates that we have a symposium on storytelling, she basically looked at me as though I was nuts. Then I told her my story. Oh. Yeah, we might do that. So the first one was a huge event by John Dealey Brown and Barry Prusak. And it was a fun event, and a whole lot of excitement was generated. And in fact, in the Washington area, the community emerged out of that, called the Golden Fleece Community, which is still at least eighth annual on these weekends and occasionally during the year, and still keeps in touch with each other. I think in that first event, the tone of the discussion was, wow, storytelling? Can you really use that in an organization? It was quite a strange new idea. And if you look back over the last 10 years, that's really changed. A lot of books have been written about this now. Had articles in Harvard Business Review. We have, a lot of us are employed. How to do this. It's become a big part of the training programs of organizations. Most leadership books now have a section at least on storytelling. It really depends on the verge of being in the mainstream. But I have to say that when I looked around early in 2008 at what would be done, I saw all these accomplishments, and I saw that we've been able to establish a lot of people who were excited and who were practicing this. We've established a lot of oases of excellence in organizations. But I also found that these individuals tend to become discouraged quite often, and these oases of excellence often were shut down by managers. When unexpectedly something would happen, there would be a budget reshuffle, and somehow or other this oasis didn't exist anymore. And it wasn't just one organization, but it was quite a lot of organizations. And I looked around, and it was also happening in knowledge management. We had an excellent knowledge management program, and then suddenly something had happened, and kaboom, whatever happened to that knowledge management program. It happened in innovation. And it seemed like all of the good and creative things in organizations were at risk from managers. So I started to think, this is crazy. My object was to make storytelling a big part of the world of organizations, and we made lots of inroads, but they were really inroads at the will of these managers. And when something happened in the organization, they were out of business. So if we are really going to make storytelling a main part of the mainstream in organizations, we have to do something about this phenomenon. So I started to look around and see what is going on, why is this happening. And I began by asking people, have they ever been in a place in one of these oases of excellence? So we're in a place somewhere where some things were humming and singing, and people were all for one for all, with enthusiasm, energy, the kind of experience you think about. And I found, as we found this morning, that pretty much everyone had had at least one experience like that. Almost everyone. That was an eye opener to me, because I had thought it would be quite hard to find these places. But if everyone's had the experience, it's not that hard. Well, I asked you, are you having it now? Well, actually, no, I'm in America. So I fit it in with these global statistics. Only one in five people are fully committed to their jobs. So that was the first discovery. Second thing was that I noticed that quite a lot of the people telling me about his experiences were in software development. And I paid no attention to this for a long while because they're all software people. What are they going to teach me about management? I'm not going to learn anything. They're geeks, right? They got into computers because they didn't like people. So. That was what I was thinking. But eventually, I mean, I met so many of them, I thought, I really need to find out what's going on. And I went and found out what they were doing, and it was really quite amazing what was going on. I met people like Jeff Sutherland, and heard about Mary Popenick, and others, Ken Schrader, and what I found is that these organizations had found a way to kind of bottle what we were hearing about the story. That, I mean, you think about Toyota, well, it can never be Toyota because it has this 70-year history, and it can never be Toyota. And the 3M, it can never be 3M because they have this strange history. Sorry, great, it's very strange. We could never be that. What these people were doing were taking traditional organizations and taking fairly ordinary kind of people and creating these kinds of experiences, creating extraordinary experiences in traditional environments and doing it on a sustained basis. And so I thought, well, this is quite amazing. This is really quite exciting. And no one knows about this. It goes under these strange names that were mentioned once or twice this morning, Scrum, Agile, and the vocabulary within those. Sprint. From masters and all sorts of funny stuff. It's what we were talking about this morning, this organization which is up here, yeah. Where, and there are a set of practices, which I'll explain in a moment what I think of the potential practices. There's a way of developing software, focused on delighting clients, working in self-organizing teams, working in short cycles, transparent, continuous improvement. Yeah.
But Scrum is a rugby thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And so the theory is that everybody sort of gets together like a Scrum and rugby and sprints down the field together in a short sprint to get something done and then you go to
the only problem with that particular analogy is that if you've ever watched a game of rugby,
you don't
want
to use it.
Scrum is not something that moves the ball forward. The scrum is a deadlock between two opposing forces. It does not move the ball. The object in rugby is to get the ball out of the scrum because the scrum is a motionless gridlock.
The scrum is over was named by somebody who didn't get rugby.
So the scrum has. The terms are problematic, but what was happening, the reality, I mean, here were these teams, these groups, these departments, divisions, were coming and thinking, I mean, they're really energetic. So I thought, this is really quite amazing, what is going on there. The terminology is impossible, but what is happening there is amazing. And I also saw that it happened quite a large extent in car manufacturing, Toyota, Honda, and companies like that. Fuji, Xerox, a number of Japanese companies, 3M. All got to this level up here, and they were doing things in a fairly similar kind of way. It wasn't being explained terribly well in the books about Scrum or Agile or Lean. In a book like Machine that created a little change the world, which is sort of in. Introduce Lean to the world. I mean, Larry's books start to give you some sense of the spirit of this, the heart of it, which is missing in so many of the other books. And I thought there is a place to try to explain what is going on in these organizations which have got to this level, turning ordinary people into extraordinary. How does that happen? What are the elements of it? And if we could do that, then we could take some of these organizations which are down here and we could help them get up to here. So that's what my current work is about. And let me just tell you about a couple of the elements that I'm going to do, a couple of little interactive exercises about. The first thing that the thinking in these organizations is doing, what 3M does, what Toyota, which is functioning properly, does, And when Elizabeth was talking about this morning, is that they focus on delighting the people that they are working for. They're not producing so many things, so many widgets, so many goods and services. They are focusing on who are we trying to do this stuff for, and how can we do it better? How can we help them better? How can we make these people excited so that they want more of what we are and what we're doing? Can we delight them? And these organizations focus in a systematic way on delighting the people that they are doing their stuff for, turning them into passionate fans of what the organization is. And that's a very common characteristic of these organizations which are up here. When I look at, say, the largest organizations in the world, I looked at the websites of the largest organizations in the world, are they aiming at that? Not according to their websites. They are basically aimed at producing goods and services of a certain type. That's what they say on their own public website. So they might have other things going on in their organization, but if that's what they say on their website, I wouldn't be surprised to find out within the organization that they're not actually trying to delight us. So we shouldn't be surprised they don't delight us. They don't delight the people who are working there. They're not even trying. So the first step, if you like, is to plant those flags in the ground and say, we need to delight the people that we are doing our work for. So I'm going to suggest you sit into groups of three, hold your chairs, and have a discussion in a group of three. In your organization, what is your goal? Are you aiming to delight your clients, or are you aiming to produce goods and services, make money if you don't care? What is the dynamic of your organization? I'd like to take a couple of things in response. It's your organization, the organization with the other members of the group. Are they focused on delighting the people they're doing the work for, creating a positive fan, or are they producing goods and services? Yeah.
One of the things we discovered is that delight means different things to different people. So it's like a term, so to speak, okay. The difference.
Okay.
Okay.
And you clarified that?
By our example.
Okay. Your organizations are doing that? They are focused on the line of people?
The healthcare organizations that I just left really are.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you come up with other words for delight?
Yeah. Editor of an article I'm writing once, did you call it continuous value adding?
Boring.
I think the light is good.
Utility company, we used an approach where we said we want you to seduce your customer. Of course, you know, boy, you can do that. But what it meant was to surprise agreeably, and I think that that's what's at the core of delighting. Your client is expecting this. So if you give them this, that, whoop, you get a smile. You get a smile, you get a connection, you get a connection, it goes on. So, to me, delight is to surprise agreeably.
Not necessarily with more, as we were hearing before lunch, and maybe with less. My DVD controller has 500,000 commands on it, and I don't know how to use it. I would be delighted if I had these things. One or two buttons, and all the 500,000 others were somewhere hidden away, right? I would be delighted by that.
This question shows up differently in the public sector. And if money is changing hands where I work, then it's time to call the inspector general. Also, in terms of delight, we're not necessarily looking for delight as the outcome in the work that we produce with our customers. Sometimes we're looking for alarm. You know, sometimes we're looking to rouse people to action, to get decisions made. And
it does play out in some parts of the public sector differently. And in a lot of the work we delight people to focus on a particular segment of the population and really delight that segment. If you try to delight everyone, you know, no one. But if you, in the justice system, for instance, if you start trying to delight a segment of the population, the antithesis of what you're trying to accomplish is to take a equality for all. So there are adjustments to be made in some parts of the public sector, but many parts of the public sector, it's the same dynamic. Who are you trying to provide, meant to be providing these services for? How can you provide more, better, sooner, fuller, whatever? So you have to be careful that some parts of the public sector are.
I'm part of State University in Pennsylvania, and we've had, with the downturn in the economy, massive growth because students can't find jobs here come to college. And we have the largest growth of the 14 state schools in our state. A problem is that they're not hiring faculty to go with the mad rise of employment of students. And so now we're creating a situation where what our mission has been to have small student-faculty ratio, have, you know, our contract doesn't allow graduate assistants to teach classes, all that, you know, now they're trying to be creative, so they're putting a lot of programs online. So you have people who are in, you know, South Florida teaching the kids who are trudging around in the 5 feet of snow. So they don't wear plaid, we call them, because we have an organization that's tied to Scottish it's Edinburgh University, and so, you know, some of them don't wear a plaid. They don't buy into our whole mission because they've never even set foot on campus. They're on the beach teaching their course online. So it creates a disconnect, and then the students feel that disconnect, and they don't feel, you know, part of the organization.
To make this happen, you have to have, first of all, the organization may happen consistently. You have to have the organization at the top saying this is our goal is, and then have that communicated to everyone throughout the organization. And it makes a huge, huge difference if you shift from producing goods and services to trying to delight clients, trying to turn them into advocates, supporters, fans of your organization. A book like this, sort of standard management textbook, which is taught in many business schools all around the world, assumes that the purpose of management is to produce goods and services. The basic assumption is, or this is about setting up the organization to produce goods and services in the most efficient way. And if you do that, all of the rest of bureaucracy, of command and control, follows from that. If you take the other road and say, we are trying to delight our clients, we are trying to turn those people into supporters and fans of what we're doing, you are undertaking a radically different kind of activity. You are now moved from a linear path to a complex path. Producing goods and services can be finite. It can be accomplished 100% of the time. It can be accomplished without mistakes. And you do it, and it's done, and it's under your control. It's a closed system. The lightning client has no clear answer. We don't know what will delight clients. It's a mystery, as Malcolm Gladwell calls it. Not a puzzle which can be solved, but a mystery which might have many different answers, and it's a matter of exploring and trying to find our way to continually better and better approaches to delighting clients. So it's an open activity. It has no finite answer. So it's a radically different way, radically different goal, and it has radically different consequences for the way the organization is managed. So you see, an organization like Starbucks or Southwest Airlines, which has in fact the goal of delighting its clients, is organized in a different way. They organize not in a bureaucracy with command and control, but in teams, kind of thing Elizabeth was talking about, self-organizing teams, where you put the teams together and say, look guys, gals, it's up to you to figure out how we can delight the people we're meant to be providing the services for, and calling on the best that those people can offer. And it's a gift that those people give every day. And unless you actually give them the scope and the opportunity to do that, then that's not going to happen. So self-organizing teams, described in a wonderful article, 1986, from Harvard Business Review, the new product development game by Bill Marker, wonderful article, saying why in order to innovate on a continuous basis so that you can delight clients, you need to organize in self-organizing teams, small self-organizing teams, which are given the scope for the people to contribute what they have to do. So it's focusing on delighting clients, organizing through self-organizing teams. And as Elizabeth described this morning, working in short cycles. The reason why sports is fun is because you have decisions. At the end of the day, end of the game is over. You can see who won. This is about creating short cycles where you can see whether you actually accomplish what you do. And if you don't, what to do about it. Because once you're in the world of delighting clients, you're going to have failures. You're going to have many failures. Which is quite different from producing goods and services. But there's something that can be accomplished every time, and you can eliminate mistakes. And in fact, you start punishing people for making mistakes. If you start trying to do that when you're delighting clients, you're going to destroy the organization, because in order to delight clients, you have to make many different attempts at trying to do it and figuring it out, well, that didn't work, how do we do it another time? So it's organizing and self-organizing teams, working in short cycles, and delivering value, real value at the end of each cycle, so you can see from the client, did they like it, did they hate it, what was the result, and doing that over and over again so that you're continually progressing towards a state where you can delight the client. And then, transparency. Let me tell you my experience with transparency. I, as you know, worked in the World Bank many years, and in that organization, I came across a man called Robert McNamara, who was the president of the World Bank from 1968 to 1981. He was, before that, was the president of Ford, briefly, and Secretary of Defense from the U.S. in the 60s, and he then became president of the World Bank for those 13 years. He was, according to President Kennedy, the smartest man President Kennedy had ever met. He was a very, very smart man. He was renowned for his most famous managers of the 20th century. He came to the World Bank, and he had a very big impact on the World Bank. He expanded lending tenfold in the space of 13 years. He turned this sleepy little boutique organization into a huge multinational, global organization. And he did, in fact, refocus the organization on poverty, more than has happened in the past. He did introduce new elements like nutrition and population and environment and a whole lot of support the organization. But my encounter with him happened in the late 1970s. I was working in the Western Athletic Department at the time, and he had offered to come to our staff meeting and answer any question. Any question? Well, the question that was on everyone's lips at the time was, is this tremendous push to expand lending happening at the cost of poverty? Every conversation in the corridor and the cafeteria was about this, that this organization was being pushed by the president to undermine quality by pushing out too much lending. And so he's offered to answer any questions, so I asked him that question. Do you think, sir, that the pace at which we're expanding lending is compatible with maintaining, at least maintaining the quality standards that we have in this organization? And he gave a very forceful answer that there was really no conflict between the two. We obviously had to have high quality, and we had to expand lending, and there was no conflict between the two. And if anyone couldn't see that, they didn't deserve to work in the World Bank.
Oh,
next question.
Not for any questions.
Now, this was a quite striking experience for me. in fact, 10 years later, the studies came out and showed that, in fact, it was true that the effort to expand lending had, in fact, dramatically undermined the quality of the loans, and all sorts of problems that emerged from the loans that we were doing. But that was a question which could not be addressed when the president of the World Bank is aggressively and eloquently saying that it's not possible to discuss that question. And it was non-transparency, if you like, in the organization. Now, non-transparency is one term for describing it, but there's another term to describe it also. There's an interesting book by a Christian philosopher called Harry Frankfurt, and it's called On Bullshit. And he says there's a difference between lying and bullshitting. Lying is saying something that you know is wrong. Bullshitting is saying something when you don't really care whether it's true or not. So I think we can acquit Robert McNamara of lying when he told me that there was no conflict between quality and quantity. But I don't think we can acquit him of bullshit. I'm not really picking on Robert McNamara here. I think if you'd ask Jack Welch or any of the famous managers of the 20th century that question, they would have given exactly the same answer. So it's not individual bullshit that I'm concerned about. It is institutional bullshit. And that is the disease with which the bureaucracies suffer. In fact, the storytelling conference, Hans Christian Andersen, I think, put his finger on this with his fable about the emperor's clothes. And that fable is well known in part, but there's a familiar part to that fable and an unfamiliar part. The familiar part of the fable is that the emperor is swindled by these people who tell him that they have this one material that only the wise and the rich and the powerful can see, and if you're not wise and rich and powerful, it will look invisible. So it pays a lot of money for this non-existent form. And then he goes and parades around the town, followed by his nobles, and the boy shouts out, the emperor's not wearing his clothes. That's the familiar part. The unfamiliar part of the tale is nothing changes. The emperor keeps walking, though nothing has happened. The court yet keeps following, though nothing has happened. The realization, everybody knows that it's not true, but no one maybe changed. And what he's figured on, the fact that in a hierarchy, in a bureaucracy, that truths which are in conflict with the power structure are trumped by falsehoods which support the power structure. And this is the inherent nature of hierarchies and bureaucracy. So if you're managing an organization like this in a hierarchy and bureaucracy, you are going to have many frequent examples of truths, which everyone knows are true, but which are in tension with the existing power structure and cannot be discussed. And if you're trying to delight clients, that is a real problem. If you're simply trying to produce goods and services, then you don't need to have transparency, because you can set the thing up where you don't need to people to tell what's going on. But if you're trying to tackle this much more ambitious goal of delighting clients, then you actually have to have truth. You have to have real understanding what's the best possible intelligence we have about what might work in this very much more difficult task we are taking on. So there is a radical difference between a world in which you are trying to accomplish this more complex goal and encouraging radical transparency, and a world in which it's just not needed, and you go along with whatever also delights up the management is saying. And the practices that Elizabeth comes to use our management are aimed at reinforcing radical transparency. It's not that these people suddenly become super honest. It's that the practices are put in place to encourage openness. One of the most important is a daily stand-up meeting in which we mentioned about the 15 minutes every day. People say, what did I do yesterday? What am I going to do today? What impediments are getting in my way? If you answer those questions every day for an extended period, everybody knows everything. Managers know what's going on. You know what's going on in the team. You know who's screwing up. You know who's actually accomplishing miracles. It becomes a radically open environment. And because for someone who isn't ready for radical transparency, it becomes a very threatening environment. So it's a very different kind of environment from the Emperor's clothes, Robert McNamara. You can't talk about those issues. It's a very, very different kind of environment. So let's spend another 5 minutes and form another small group, different small group, and discuss in your organization how difficult would it be for you to establish radical transparency. Is this something that's already there? Or is it something that would be easy or something that would be very difficult? Is it something that can even be envisioned? Yeah.
Are there any other people in here for business for themselves? Because I'm not in the organization.
Move okay. Around.
And discuss this right at the end of the day, so you might
received the five hypotheses, and you might have quite different hypotheses about the role of storytelling in organizations. This is looking back over the 10-year experience and all the people who come to these Smithsonian events and come to the Golden Fleece meetings and talk to me online or whatever and talk about what is the role of storytelling. So here are five hypotheses. One is that storytelling is really something sacred, something that is pure, something that really shouldn't be in organizations at all, and that we should sit on the ground and hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and that's happening already. the whole idea of introducing storytelling in organizations is a mistake. I've heard people make that case. That's one hypothesis. Second hypothesis is that storytelling is something that's doing quite well in organizations, it's sort of like a ping pong club, that storytellers get together and they tell stories with each other, and they're kind of tolerated by the management, you can throw them an occasional bone and support them, but they live at the pleasure of the management. The management can close the ping pong club down at any moment, they can close the storytelling activity down at any moment. For some people, that's really good enough. So if we can establish a group of storytellers and we're doing our thing and we're sharing stories and we're talking with each other about that, that's okay. Third hypothesis, don't ask, don't tell. We do storytelling, but we don't tell the management we're doing it. And to some extent, that's what I was doing in the World Bank back in the 90s. The first time the World Bank management heard about using storytelling as a tool was when they read my book. That's what he was doing. It's only so far you can go. Eventually people figure out what you're doing. But that's one possibility. Fourth possibility is storytelling is a leadership tool, an explicit leadership tool. And that's what my role has been over the last probably 10 years, is introducing and explaining storytelling as a leadership tool. When I started out in the early 2000s and I proposed a workshop, managers would say, well, let's call it strategic change management. I don't want to worry people because storytelling now what happens is, if I propose a topic like that, why don't we call it what it is? It's a storytelling, right? That's what we want. We want storytelling. So it's out in the open, and it's a leadership tool, and it's in most of the leadership books, and it's in Jim Kruse's book, or Aaron Pink's book. They all have storytelling sections. It's become a sort of accepted thing leaders might have that. So that's another possible role. Storytelling is one of the tools of a leader. The fifth hypothesis that I'm now exploring in my new book is that it needs to take a bigger step and really change the whole organization. Make storytelling change the way managers manage. To make books like this extinct. In the crevices and cracks of this book, you can find a lot of these truths, but they're in the crevices and footnotes. They need to be up front, and the kind of things which are up front need to be put back in the cracks and crevices. It's not explaining that organizations, be up here, have to be run very differently. If you run them according to this book, you're going to end up with them down there. And so that's why I'm suggesting that we have to tackle this bigger question of how organizations manage. Now, what to call it, argument going on about that is, it was the publisher who suggested that I call it radical management. I was explaining this is when you do this, everything is different. Feels different, works differently, has different impact. It becomes a different kind of organization. So why not call it radical management? So that's what I'm calling it. And not everyone likes that term. If there's a better term out there, I'd love to know what it is. But it's, what is this thing that would describe organizations which are at this level rather than that level? Because you can see Scrum and Agile as being a subset of it in software development, and Lean being a subset of it in manufacturing. What is the term that would describe this as a way of running whole organizations in this way, which excites people, which delights clients, which creates a
warm-up?